Good morning again. Excuse me. So in the gospel reading, we have a fairly famous moment. 10 people with leprosy kind of hail Jesus from a distance. And they have to do that because if you have leprosy, you can't go near people. Now, a couple of things there. The New Testament, when it uses the word leprosy, it, as best we can tell, it just means skin problem, skin condition. They didn't really differentiate between them. If you use the word leprosy today in a medical context, it means something very specific, a specific kind of bacteria that causes it. And because I like to waste time, I looked up, you know, what is the prevalence of leprosy in the modern day? And it turns out it does still exist. And you know, does anyone here know what one of the main vectors for humans contracting actual leprosy is? It's armadillos. Yeah. And after I Googled that, it kept saying, like, do not eat the meat of an armadillo. So that's just good advice. so don't do that. You know, roadkill and all, whatever. Nevertheless, the problem with skin diseases or leprosy in a first century, roughly Jewish context is that it separates you from the rest of your culture. The nature of the disease meant that you were ritually unclean. It's not a moral problem. You just were ritually unclean, so you also could not approach the presence of God in the temple, because the temple is a place where everything is whole and clean. So it separates you from your God, and it separates you from your friends and family. That's a nasty situation. And the process by which you can overcome this is a little involved. I mean, first, the skin condition has to go away, so good luck. And then you actually have to go show yourself to a priest, and the priests will be specifically trained, and you can read about this in Leviticus, good luck, to determine if the infection is gone, in which case you'll have to wash yourself in a certain way, and then you'll be good to go. So the people who are hailing Jesus from a distance are kind of following the rules. And they ask him to heal them. And Jesus says very, like, almost bluntly, he doesn't even explain what he's going to do. He says, go show yourselves to the priest. And so they go. Now Luke, as he is narrating this story, is building tension that we don't know is there yet. And he kind of buries the lead because eventually, as those guys are going, they realize that things are clearing up, and only one returns. And he goes and falls down at Jesus' feet, the traditional posture of worship. And then Luke hits us with the punchline. Now, he was a Samaritan. And if this was like a cheesy mystery movie or something like that, you'd expect the orchestra to hit right then, like, dun-da, whoa, he's a Samaritan. And that makes little sense to us today. So we need to unpack that just for a moment. Samaria, and therefore Samaritans, started coming into existence after the Assyrians wiped out the northern tribes of Israel. And this that conquest was in the year 722 BC. And the Assyrians had a practice where if they conquered a people, they would deport some of them and import other people from other places that they conquered, because if you don't speak the same language, have no cultural ties, and don't worship the same God as your neighbors, you're not likely to get together and revolt. They were kind of right, but they were also terrible at managing empires, and they fell apart pretty fast. But nevertheless, what this created was a group of people in a region that developed kind of in parallel to Judah to the south, or which became Judea. And so the Samaritans shared a lot of similarities by the first century, to the Jewish people. They had similar scriptures, at least in the first five books of the Bible, similar like language, similar worship practices. But they were also different. And those differences were really hard for everybody to overcome. And Samaritans and Jewish people hated each other to the point that they exchanged blows across borders. Like, blood was shed, and there was no innocent party. Everyone was terrible to each other, which is kind of, broadly speaking, the story of human history. But anyway, one of the main differences had to do with the question of God. And in our culture today, questions about God start from a very different place from back then. So today, if we want to have, like, broadly, culturally speaking, I'm not talking about within our church, you have to start maybe with, like, well, is there a God? I'm not questioning if there's a God. I'm saying that's how conversations start. Is there a God? And if there's a God, what is God like? Does God have a personality, or is God like this absolute all-encompassing being, you know, whatever? There's lots of different ways that our culture will answer that question. Generally speaking, that's not the question of Jesus' day, because they would be more interested in where is God and where is God worshiped. Not where do you go to church, but where is the place where God makes his presence? And that's very, very different from how we would understand this. There's also, of course, within Jewish and Christian thought, by the time of Jesus, that God maybe isn't bound by like an actual place, that God is in fact everywhere, but it wasn't settled yet. And the reason why all of this is actually relevant is that if you asked a Samaritan, where is God, they would point to Mount Gerizim, which is about 30-ish miles north of Jerusalem. If you ask a Jewish person, where is God, they would say, well, he is in his temple on Mount Zion in Jerusalem. That difference is fundamental and critical for understanding this moment and this interaction that Jesus has. Because Jesus is Jewish. Shocking. He looks Jewish. Like, everyone will know just based on what he's wearing and how he carries his beard and that kind of thing. And so if Jesus, a Jewish man, says, go show yourselves to the priest, there's only one place he has in mind. I mean, he's not like, yeah, go. Any priest will do. If it's a priest of Apollo or Aphrodite, that's fine. No, nonsense. He means in Jerusalem. When we learn that this one guy is a Samaritan, we realize he's got a problem. He just heard a Jewish teacher and healer say, go show yourself to the priest. And if you ask this guy, where is God, his answer will be, well, in Mount Gerizim. Because that's where God is, that's where God is worshipped, that's where we approach his presence with the proper sacrifices. So there's a little bit of like an internal conflict there, and modern people will miss this. And so as they are going, they realize things are clean, and something causes the Samaritan man to suddenly get it. Because where does he go to worship? The feet of Jesus. Not Mount Gerizim, not Mount Zion. This is why Jesus reacts the way he does. It sounds like he's being derisive or something when he says, no one's here except for this foreigner. We hear that as like a negative thing, but it's maybe shock, because he then honors this man. Because out of everybody, he's the one, this guy is the one that figures out this is where God is. Now, as a test case, if in your on your own time, go back and read John 4 and the conversation between Jesus and the woman at the well. It's that entire conversation is about, is God a Mount Gerizim or Mount Zion? And the answer is neither. He's right here. Anyway, so Jesus is now standing there, and the one guy that should not have gotten it, a Samaritan man, has suddenly identified where God really is. He's not in a temple, not anymore. He's in flesh, and he's right in front of us. And with that in mind, we can start then asking maybe slightly more modern questions. What is God like? Does God have a personality? Who is God? And the Christian answer to this is that if you want to know what God is like, start with Jesus. Because God, or Jesus, is the primary, the best, the first place to start when you want to know who God is. Now, there are lots of ways that we can talk about how Jesus reveals who God is, but we're going to take one particular avenue. Because as Luke is telling this story and he's threading a whole bunch of needles, this is late in the story of Jesus' life. And ever since chapter 9, Jesus has been on a collision course with Jerusalem. And he's been telling his disciples, hey, I'm going to go there and it's going to go poorly, to say the least. But this is what has to happen. His disciples don't really get it. A few people, the wrong people, get it. But not the people that you would expect. And when he goes to Jerusalem, which happens in like two chapters, and the powers that be, and really the powers that oversee the temple, deep irony there, are the ones who orchestrate Jesus' brutal death, which then leads to his defeat of death. So, if we want to know what God is like, and we examine or we answer that question through the lens of Jesus, what does that tell us? God gave God's self to us. It's hard to overstate how wild that is. Every other religious tradition system, however you want to define it, the word religion itself is actually really hard to define. But every other religious system or tradition will require something from you. In Jesus' day, that was sacrifices, blood sacrifices, and there's a whole system behind that. There's certain kinds of obedience, even in the modern day. You have to do certain things, be involved in certain things, and so on and so forth. There are, in other words, very, very significant expectations and demands that certain understandings of God might make. But not in the way of Jesus. Jesus demands nothing. To have a place at God's table does not require anything from you, because Jesus has given himself so that you have that place. In the first service, we baptized a baby, Hayden, little Hayden. He did not earn that. He's not even potty trained. Like, what is he going to do? There are no good works that he can do to prove himself to God. And yet, he was still buried with Jesus in the waters of baptism and raised to new life. That promise is no less true. The same, therefore, is true for us. Like, you want a place at the table, at God's table? Well, Jesus already paid that. And it cost him his life. Now, this can be a little bit frustrating sometimes because we naturally have this inclination to then ask, well, yeah, but what do I have to do? You haven't talked about what Jesus demands of me, from me. And there, the way of being a disciple of Jesus does involve a whole lot of things. It loving your neighbor, that's a good one to start with. Jesus seemed really big on that. Caring for those who need it, feeding the hungry, caring for the poor, standing up for the oppressed, living a life of justice and mercy. All of those are really, really good things. Please do them. The world in which we live desperately needs them. They do not earn you a place at the table of God. Because how would you know if you've done enough? And you've probably heard me say this before, but I will say this my entire career. The word enough is spiritual poison. And all it does is tear you down. Have I been good enough? Have I tithed enough? Have I served the poor and those in need in my community enough? Do I love my wife enough? And do I care for my family enough? Am I good enough at my job? Am I living out my vocation well enough? The answer, if you want to be really honest, is probably not. Because we're all human. But if we want to know what God is like and what God demands, we look at Jesus and it turns out none of that matters. Because in the words of the old hymn, Jesus paid it all. And so if we want to know what it means to follow God, what it means to have a place at God's table, we want to know what God is like, what his personality is, if we can call it that. For us, that journey begins with God has given himself for you and me. And his grace is so extravagant that I think it's safe to say that Jesus gave himself even for the people that did it to him. And so out of everything else that we can learn from this, the wrong guy who comes and falls flat on his face in the traditional posture of worship before Jesus, we learn that God gives himself for you. There is no room for question about what you have to do. That's not how the economy of God works. There is no amount of this or that. It will never be enough, so it's an irrelevant question because God simply did it. And then we get to live as ongoing followers of Jesus in that grace. That is our starting point and our ending point. God has defeated the darkness in you and me. He has defeated death, that final great and terrible enemy. And he gives it all to us. Amen. As you are able, please rise.